I'm Father Daniel Sparks. I'm an assisting priest at Good Shepherd Reformed Episcopal Church in Tyler, Texas, a couple hours drive east of here. We're talking about C.S. Lewis and the church. And I will tell you up front that, unfortunately, I won't be able to get through all my material today. But if you would like for me to... if you'd like to get a copy of my complete notes, I'll be happy to send those to you by email. If you'll just send me an email. If you can read my chicken scratch, daniel@danielsparks.com. Just send me an email and I'll send you those notes. It'll be maybe next week. Because I'll be on the road for a bit. But anyway, I want to make sure you had were able to see this first, because last time I got wound up and ran out of time. So I wanted to make sure, if you're interested in reading more about Lewis, you have know about some resources here. This is Surprised by Joy, Lewis's autobiography of his early life. It primarily focuses on his childhood and teenage years, and that's the major portion and where he's most detailed. He says in his preface that's intentional. Likewise, my presentation today will mostly focus on his early life. This is, I don't know who designed the cover of that. It's kind of hard to read. The Christian World of C.S. Lewis by Clyde Kilby, who was a friend of Lewis. This one, unfortunately, is not in print right now, but you might find used copies. This is by Roger Green and Walter Hooper, also friends of Lewis. And Hooper was Lewis's secretary the last bit of his life and when he died. Both of these were published in the 60s, I believe. Jack, George Sayer, another friend of Lewis, I think that was published in the 80s. And then Alistair McGrath's book came out last year. He makes a big deal about when the bluebells were blooming, but if you can get past all of that, it's a pretty good story, biography. And then the Christian History Magazine, this is from 2005, but it is, you still can get a print copy, or you can download text only online for free. The Christian World of C.S. Lewis, I think, is a really good book. Gives a bit of biography of Lewis. It's not as complete as some of these other full-blown biographies, but it also touches on each of his major books and tells a bit about them, the themes in them, and then it just examines some overall themes in Lewis's writings. So here in a little bit, I'll give you somebody this, and I also have a copy of... Is there anyone here who has never read Mere Christianity? Okay, anybody here who's just got a friend that you'd really love to give a copy of Mere Christianity to? Okay, well, I'll just hang on to it then. All right. I never met C.S. Lewis, but I don't think I would have felt at ease with him, nor am I entirely at ease with his God. Lewis, I am sure, would have applauded this discomfort. This is Bishop of Oxford some years ago. I think he's right. I would have the same assessment. Lewis's God is someone that it's difficult to be familiar with, familiar in the vulgar sense. And this is the rest of this quote, which we'll come back to in a moment, is really what the bishop was getting at here. Lewis really tried to present God in all of his holiness, in all of his majesty. Not an unapproachable God, but certainly someone far above our small ability to to comprehend, and certainly beyond our ability to approach in holiness. Perhaps no other man had more influence in the 20th century than C.S. Lewis as regarded the Christian faith. His lectures, his arguments, his writings, and his life are still read and scrutinized, of course, by both scholars and laymen. And virtually all of his books that he published, that he wrote, are all in print still. Even the most academic, arcane books on medieval literature and things like that. In fact, those books are some of the standards still in the study of literature, English literature. All of this, of course, is quite interesting considering that Lewis was once an atheist. In fact, it seems that Lewis's life was an oddity throughout his lifetime, even in his own eyes. You might describe it as a great big oxymoron. Here's the hardened atheist in his teenage years and even up through into his 30s, becoming the most popular writer in Christianity at the time, in the last few years of his life. Certainly Lewis would describe his entire life as colorfully as he did in his early life in Surprised by Joy. His life was very colorful, and I think in that regard it continues to color our world today in our understanding of the faith. If I'm going too fast, wave your hand at me or something. I want to fit in as much as possible, but I get carried away sometimes, and my good old Alabama accent slurs my words. So, let's see. So Lewis was from Northern Ireland. There's Northern Ireland. Here's the Republic of Ireland, sort of a boot shape here. Scotland, England, Wales over here. The terrain of Ireland, I'm not sure how you can make this out, but Belfast is here. This is where Lewis and his family were from. In this area here, right in this area around Belfast, you have lowlands, and then you have rolling hills to the north and south. And then these dark areas you see here are the mountains. These are the Mourne Mountains, which greatly impacted Lewis and give him a lot of the imagery that he brought into the Chronicles of Narnia. What do we know about Northern Ireland, particularly during Lewis's lifetime around the turn of the century, the 20th century? Troubles, yes. So, in Northern Ireland, you had the rule by the English as part of the United Kingdom. In the Republic of Ireland, it was an independent country. Still is that way today. And in Northern Ireland, there's strong Protestantism, the Church of England. And in the Republic of Ireland, there is strong Catholicism. And so you always have this, even today, there's this tension there, this ongoing murder and mayhem. It's less prominent these days, thankfully, but all of that's going on there. As a child, Lewis attended church with his family, and his grandfather, Thomas Hamilton, who was his mother's father, was the first rector of the parish church at St. Mark's in the parish of Dundella, located in Belfast. The church building was designed by William Butterfield, an Englishman, to reflect the thinking of the Tractarian movement. The church was completed in 1878, and Lewis was baptized here by his grandfather on January 29th, 1899. Here's the entry of Lewis's baptism in the church register. Baptized by his grandfather. Here's the outside of St. Mark's. In an interior view, now these are fairly recent. Think for a moment. So Northern Ireland, heavily Protestant, very conservative, very allied with the British Crown, very much steeped in the tradition of the Elizabethan settlement, drawing on what you may know from Anglican history. So this is kind of the in-between of worship, pulling the high and low together. But this is a very low church evangelical country by and large. But you have this church designed by an Englishman, not an Irishman. An Englishman whose architecture reflects the values of the Tractarian movement. And the Tractarian movement, or the Oxford movement, was that movement in the early 1800s and developed throughout the 19th century, particularly, that has now brought us the Anglo-Catholic tradition, as it's known today, really focused on high church worship based on principles of the medieval church and the primitive church. So really going back and bringing in some of the way we see it practically are the smells and bells, so to speak, though there's a whole theology that goes along with that. I assume all of you know in a nutshell about that, but so you have this very dyed-in-the-wool evangelical church, but you have an architecture that reflects Tractarianism. This is not the first contradictory or perhaps oxymoronic thing that goes on in Lewis's life. So what do you see here that may reflect high churchmanship? Okay, stained glass.
All the intricate carvings.
Yes. So these arches, there's carvings and things up here. It's not real clear how to see that, but there's kind of a sunburst carving there. Oddly enough, the stained glass, the Anglo-Catholic architect designed the building to have clear glass windows. Compound irony upon irony. And so there was this church building, half the building has stained glass and the other half has clear glass, because after they got all these stained glass windows installed, somebody finally discovered that the original plans called for clear glass, and so they stopped putting stained glass in the church. Now that was probably 100 years after it was built, but anyway. So with that setting, keep that in mind, because I think that really, in some sense, epitomizes the rest of Lewis' life. Lewis despised his grandfather's sermons. He thought they were dry and dead. Mostly what his grandfather preached about was the heresy of the Roman Catholic Church and how horrible the Roman Church was. And he accomplished very little otherwise in his sermons. And the services were therefore dull, boring, and meaningless to Lewis and his brother Warren, or Warney. And in fact, it seems like most of the parishioners in the church there felt the same way. Church going was more a political act than a religious act. How might that be the case?
Because the ruler of England was Protestant.
Okay. Okay. So, in fact, I think Lewis says in Surprised by Joy, the baker and the butcher came to church there so that they could show everyone else that when you come to my shop and buy your meat, you're buying good Protestant meat, not Roman Catholic meat. So they came there to show that they were not Roman Catholics. Now, of course, there were some Catholics in Northern Ireland, but heaven help them.
Could it also be, we have, especially in Dallas, it's a certain, the statement of a certain social class.
Yes.
You go to this church if you want to, you know, be considered part of this group, you know, not just political, but social.
Right.
Your connection.
Yes. And that was a big thing with Lewis's father that we'll come back to in a couple of minutes. Well, with this kind of background in Lewis's parish church as a child, with his grandfather preaching these dry, boring, meaningless sermons where he just ranted and raved about the horror of Babylon or Rome, as the case may be, you can see how Lewis might have been negatively influenced, even as a small child, toward atheism, or at least into thinking that Christianity and the doctrines of the faith were meaningless and insignificant. And the reason I'm focusing on this so much is because, as I said, I think this, in some sense, epitomizes the rest of Lewis's life. It had a profound influence on him, particularly in his coldness toward the Christian faith that comes out later. Lewis's mother came from a family with a background of a variety of professional folks, including clergymen. Obviously, her father being a rector of the parish there. She was a churchgoer, but she did not do anything to teach Lewis any devotion, at least nothing that we have any record of. If you read Lewis's autobiography, you find that he was very emotionally disturbed when his mother passed away, as any child of 8 years old might be. But this is something that influenced him, affected him the rest of his life. But he doesn't really ever say much about his mother, so we don't quite know how much she influenced him, but she didn't seem to really influence him to embrace the faith in any kind of meaningful way. However, my reading between the lines, my interpretation of that, is she seems to have been a quiet, gentle lady who took care of her home and her children, made sure they were had what they needed, were cared for, and was submissive to her husband and followed his leadership. Lewis's father was quite a loud, obnoxious person, according to Lewis and Warney. And so his mother probably had the quieter role. So we don't have any record of her really doing much to influence him in religion, which would have reflected more of his father's leadership. Lewis's father was a Welshman. Lewis's mother was Irish. His father was Welsh. And he loved the charm of the tradition and the verbal beauty of the Bible and prayer book. Let me stop for a moment, getting ahead of myself here. So this is Lewis's grandfather. I've already mentioned these things. So Lewis is baptized in the church on January 29th, 1899. Receive this child into the congregation of Christ's flock, and do sign him with the sign of the cross, in token that hereafter he shall not be ashamed to confess the faith of Christ crucified, and manfully to fight under his banner against sin, the world, and the devil, and to continue Christ's faithful soldier and servant unto his life's end. It's from the 1878 Book of Common Prayer of the Church of Ireland, which had just recently been disestablished, been released from the authority of the Church of England, had its own prayer book. Very interesting, baptizing children, putting this sign upon them that they are signed by the cross of Christ and are called by His name. They are sealed by His grace, brought into the community of the family of God. And Lewis tried to run from this, but he couldn't get away. And this is something that is a recurring theme in Lewis's life. When you read Surprised by Joy or anything he talks about, where he talks about his life, no matter how much he tried to get away from the church and from belief in God, God was always pursuing him. And I think it starts right here at his baptism. Let me come back to that quote. You have it at the top of your handout here. I read the first half of this from Bishop Harries of Oxford. I want to pick up on the second line. Speaking of Lewis, he says, "He once criticized the low church milieu in which he grew up for being too cozily at ease in Zion, and particularly his grandfather, who used to look forward, as he said, to having some very interesting conversations with St. Paul when he got to heaven. It reminded Lewis of two clerical gentlemen talking at ease in a club. It never seemed to cross his mind," he commented, "that an encounter with St. Paul might be a rather overwhelming experience, even for an evangelical clergyman of good standing." So, again, you have this portrayal of Lewis's grandfather as someone who spoke of St. Paul and being in heaven in a very almost flippant manner, just kind of, "I'm going to pull up at the bar and bump elbows with St. Paul and kind of have a casual conversation with him." And you ever run into anyone that talks about Christ that way? You know, what a friend we have in Jesus. And yes, He is our friend, but He's also much more. And so Lewis gave this as an example of how insignificantly the doctrines of the faith were impressed upon the people of the parish there. How little his grandfather focused on the important things and instead railed against the Roman Catholics. Okay, now that I've had to back up and hit that, let me come back to where we were, talking about Lewis's father. Albert Lewis, he was a lawyer. He was a Welshman. And he loved the charm of the tradition and the verbal beauty of the Bible and prayer book, according to Lewis. He was also devoted to high church worship, and Lewis described him as far from being specially puritanical. So he wasn't a Puritan. He was enamored with high church worship. Now, remember Lewis's baptism in the parish church, St. Mark's? Very evangelical, dyed-in-the-wool evangelical parish. Ultra-conservative Protestant, hated Roman Catholics. You know, his grandfather's up preaching, they're all going straight to hell or something to that effect. But the parish church was built by an Anglo-Catholic. And Lewis's father loved high church worship. So here we have all of this weird mix of things going on yet again. Not only the architecture and the preaching and the things like that, but Lewis's own father preferred high church worship. At home, Lewis was taught the usual things about religion. He was taken to church and said his prayers. And yet, despite his father's interest in the church and the family traditions of nominal church involvement, Lewis wrote in his autobiography, in Surprised by Joy, that in his childhood, religious experiences did not occur at all. So there's this strong tradition of involvement in the church, but this strong practice or non-practice of any kind of real faith. When Lewis' mother died, an event that changed his life forever. Some thought that Lewis was spiritually engaged. He writes about this in Surprised by Joy, and I don't know who he's talking about or why he thought why they might have thought that of him, that he was somehow having some kind of religious experience. But he says, "My mother's death was the occasion of what some, but not I, might regard as my first religious experience." Perhaps he had a very emotional experience outwardly. I don't know. We don't have any record of that I'm aware of. But it obviously impacted him significantly. As I've said before, I believe the greatest influence upon Lewis's life, Lewis's faith, may have been the stale religion of his grandfather and father, and to a lesser degree that of his mother. His grandfather seemed to practice a lifeless faith, and his father seemed to perceive the liturgy as beautiful, but not necessarily meaningful. And I think this view of men as confessing faith, but being essentially disinterested in that faith, seems to be the bud that blossomed into Lewis's later patent atheism. And I think that he began to realize this later, after his conversion, and fought against it. And I think we see this come out in some of his writings. Middle of the first page of the handout. Again, I see we're going to be woefully short of finishing up, but I'll give you as much as I can. I want to pick up middle of that paragraph, that quote from Surprised by Joy. "My father, far from being specially puritanical, was by 19th century and Church of Ireland standards rather high, and his approach to religion as to literature was at the opposite pole from what later became my own. The charm of tradition and verbal beauty of Bible and prayer book, all of them for me laid in acquired tastes, were his natural delight, and it would have been hard to find an equally intelligent man who cared so little for metaphysics." Explain a little bit about Lewis's relationship with his father. There's much that could be said, but he and Warney had a strained relationship with their father throughout their lives. Some of it seems to have sparked from perhaps Albert's reserved emotions in response to his mother's death. He was a lawyer. He was quite a political animal. I don't recall that he held any political office, but he was very much involved in the politics of Northern Ireland and caught up in following all that was going on and talking about it quite endlessly. And his sons did not share that interest. They were more interested in creative aspects, imaginative aspects of life, literature and art and culture and that sort of thing. And they could never completely relate to him on that regard. But Lewis also talks about his father as someone who would never let an argument go and who would hear you but never really understood what you were saying. Lewis talks about, for example, we'll come to his confirmation shortly, but he was an atheist at that point already, and he wanted to talk to his father about it, but he knew even about why he did not believe in the doctrines of the faith, but he knew if he went to his father to talk to him, it would just be meaningless. His father would get all worked up and talk endlessly, but he would never come to understand why Lewis felt that way, why he believed that way. And the conversation would carry on for the rest of their lives. His father would always talk around the edges of the issue, but never address the essence of the topic. So this is kind of the problem here. You see this strain in Lewis and Warney's relationship with their father. Their father did several times try to bridge the distance between them, and they repelled him when he did so. I think he seemed as they grew up and as they became men and the distance between them grew more, I think he recognized that he had helped kind of push them away. and he tried to interact with them and overcome it, but his sons would not respond until it was too late. When his father was near death, Lewis did finally go and take care of him for a short period of time. But he really at that point wanted to make up with his father, but it was too late before he passed away. What does all that have to do with the church? Well, I think it all ties in together here. Hopefully you'll begin to see this weaving together. When Lewis' mother became sick, he prayed with a firm willpower that she might recover. And when she died, he hoped for a miraculous rising from the dead. However, when that approach didn't work, he left it by the wayside. He states that he had approached God, or my idea of God, without love, without awe, even without fear. Wonder where he got that from. His family's practice of worship seems to be the case. He approached God in the same way that many people in our culture today approach God. He's our lucky rabbit's foot. When we're in a tight spot, let's pull him out of our pocket and rub it a little bit, or wish upon a star, or whatever the case may be. And because we're such great people, he'll get us out of a fix. Now, Lewis obviously was in deep emotional distress, and so we can understand there might be some of that clouded his thinking, especially at 8 years old. He prayed, and because his prayers weren't answered, he found no reason to trust in the Lord. Shortly after his mother's death, Lewis was sent away to school at Wynyard in Hertfordshire, England. And again, forgive my Alabama accent on murdering these English pronunciations. So he goes to Wynyard. He attended church services there twice on Sundays, and he becomes what he called an effective believer. Now, exactly what he means by that, he doesn't go into a lot of detail of that little phrase, but he does tell us about his practice in school there. He was enamored with the Anglo-Catholicism of the parish church at Wynyard. Now, here's this boy coming from ultra-conservative, evangelical, Protestant Northern Ireland, and he falls in love with this Anglo-Catholic parish. This church and its worship struck him with a sense of fear, but not a fear that he judged to be unhealthy. He says it was at these church services where he first heard the doctrines of Christianity taught by men who obviously believed them. Now, this is a big change from his home parish. He's hearing all these things taught by folks who don't really seem to have anything invested in those doctrines. And he says his faith was brought to life. He began to pray and read the Bible, and he tried to live according to the designs of his conscience. He mentions, in talking about his strained relationship with his father, he mentions scribbling all of these resolutions on bits of paper and stuffing them in his pockets of things he wanted to do better and live according to his conscience, to do the right thing. And when he came home on break from school, his father sees his pockets bulging out and wants to dig in his pockets and see what he's carrying. And Lewis, fights his father and runs to the fire and tosses them all in the fire. So gives you a bit of insight into the strain of the relationship there. And Lewis and his fellow students frequently discussed religion there at Wynyard. The bottom third of your handout here, I want to pick up about the third line. He's talking about this Anglo-Catholic church. On the conscious level, I reacted strongly against its peculiarities. Was I not an Ulster Protestant, and were not these unfamiliar rituals an essential part of the hated English atmosphere? Unconsciously, I suspect, the candles and incense, the vestments and the hymns sung on our knees may have had a considerable and opposite effect on me. But I do not think they were the important thing. What really mattered was that I here heard the doctrines of Christianity as distinct from general uplift, taught by men who obviously believed them. As I had no skepticism, the effect was to bring to life what I would already have said that I believed. It's quite interesting he says this, because we don't know that he believed anything prior to this. In this experience, there was a great deal of fear. I do not think there was more than was wholesome or even necessary. But if in my books I have spoken too much of hell, and if critics want a historical explanation of the fact, they must seek it not in the supposed Puritanism of my Ulster childhood, but in the Anglo-Catholicism of the church at Belsen. Now, Belsen is what he calls the Wynyard School. He referred to it as a concentration camp, hence his nickname for it. The effect, so far as I can judge, was entirely good. I began seriously to pray and to read my Bible and to attempt to obey my conscience. Religion was among the subjects which we often discussed in an entirely healthy and profitable way, with great gravity and without hysteria. Again, very different than the environment that he was in his early childhood, where religion was discussed with flippancy and hysteria, the hysteria of the politics of Belfast. Skipping ahead here, Lewis went on to, I believe it's pronounced Charburg, if my memory is correct, and if not, sorry again for butchering it, but this was another school he went to, and here he lost his faith. And he says his disbelief was sparked by the esoteric religious flounderings of the matron, Miss Cowie. Now, she was a kindly matron, perhaps a bit naive, and she taught him that the pagan gods were to be taken seriously in the literature that he read. She said that the writers of that literature truly believed that these gods were real and all the things they were writing were real. And this is the beginning of doubt in Lewis's mind about, well, if all of these myths are real and Christianity is a myth, that doesn't all add up. All of this can't be true. And heard Dr. Crave talking about some of that with the descent into hell and Lewis and Tolkien and all that, or I think it was Bishop Sutton, actually, the first session, the long conversation with Tolkien and Dyson into the middle of the night, talking about myth and how the Christian myth is the only one that's true. Well, this is where he begins to get all muddled up at 13 years old. Now, I don't know what y'all were doing at 13, but my mind wasn't thinking all of these things, but obviously Lewis was a bit different than us, or different than myself at least. So Miss Cowie helped destroy Lewis's faith, though he did not believe she intentionally did so, just that she was a bit muddled herself. But that wasn't the only thing. Not only the influence of the matron and the influence of the literature he was reading, but also his own struggles with prayer was something that helped ruin his faith at the time. And that came from his particular practice of praying, which made it unbearable for him. And some of us may be able to relate to that, or maybe you know some folks who can relate to that. You know, we think we have these systems of prayer that are necessary, and sometimes they become obstacles to actually praying. He usually dreaded the prospect of praying in the evenings because he was always suspicious of whether he was having a true realization of prayer. Ever been there before? You know, I'm saying some words, but I'm not sure I'm really engaged, not sure I really mean it. Am I therefore praying, or am I just repeating some meaningless words? He said this turned his faith into a practice that was a quite intolerable burden. And along with that, he also experienced many temptations while he was at this school during his teenage years. A variety of temptations. Some of this was peer pressure. I think this is the point where he begins requesting more money from his father for his hair products and things like that, so he can look nice and fit in with his peers and impress others and that sort of thing. And so that was one of the temptations that he struggled with. And that period seems to be unique in Lewis's life, because prior to that and later in his life, he didn't really seem to care what other people thought of him. And he wasn't concerned about his appearance to any unhealthy degree. You know, you even read about how in their later years, he and Warney in their home at the Kilns, you know, dumped their pipe ash and stomped it in the rug of the house, the carpet in the living room or whatever. Maybe quite intolerable to the rest of us, but he wasn't concerned with those things at other times in his life, but seemed to go along with it here. He also experienced physical temptations and things along that line, and he would pray for relief of these things. He would earnestly seek the Lord and say, you know, I am sorry for these sins. Forgive me of these sins. And he would vow to never do those things again. And then he would commit the sin again. And he felt that because of this, that he was not sincere and the Lord was not answering his prayers to help him resist and overcome temptation. And so these things added to his doubt of the efficacy of his prayers. Lewis' experience in school at Malvern, which was the next school he went to, Malvern College, and Great Bookham, and his time in the army did not encourage him in religion either. You know, I'm kind of skipping, condensing a lot of things here. To him, those services were meaningless. And when he was at Great Bookham, he was under the instruction of William Kirkpatrick, who had been a friend of his father's. And it was during that time that he began to expand his mind even more in literature. And I think it was during that time where he first came under the influence of George MacDonald, reading his book Fantastes. And Lewis said in his autobiography that none of his writings did not, and there's not one of his writings that did not include something from George MacDonald in them. The influence of MacDonald was seen throughout Lewis's writings, according to him. I won't spend a lot of time talking about MacDonald, but just something in passing. But while he was there studying under Kirkpatrick, he took part in a significant rite of the church. And I've already talked a bit about his relationship with his father, so I won't reiterate that again. But because of that relationship, that emotional detachment, Lewis did not feel he could talk to his father about his atheism at that point. At 15 years old, he's a hardened atheist. And this happened within a period of probably about 3 years or thereabouts, that he really came from what he called an effective believer to being a hardened atheist. And this emotional detachment between him, lack of emotional engagement and with his father, interfered with him discussing with his father his thoughts about atheism. He did not attend church while he was in Great Bookham under the tutelage of Kirkpatrick, and he hid this fact from his father so he would not have to explain it. And despite the coldness that defined their relationship, Lewis depended on his father, Albert, for financial support. Well, when you start talking money, that changes things a bit, huh? Or at least influences things. And so Lewis kept up this attempt to please his father or appease his father, sometimes even to fool his father, so that he could minimize conflict in their relationship and keep the money flowing from his father. And because of this practice to keep his father pacified, Even though he wanted to maintain his own independent thoughts, Lewis went ahead with a service of confirmation. And at his confirmation, which was in Belfast, he went home for this, he made a vow to believe and to do those things his sponsor promised at his baptism. It's taken from the Irish Prayer Book, 1878. Now, just a note in passing, the 1878 Prayer Book had only a very short section in the confirmation service, not the full reiteration of the Apostles' Creed and so on that we see now, for example, in the American Prayer Book, or even now in the current Irish Prayer Book. But what were those things? Well, they're on your handout there, and I won't go through all of that on the second page, but I will read this first piece. The bishop says to the sponsors, "Dost thou in the name of this child renounce the devil and all his works, the vain pomp and glory of the world, with all covetous desires of the same, and the sinful desires of the flesh, so that thou wilt not fall nor be led by them?" And so his sponsors make that promise. And so here's Lewis standing in front of the bishop. "Do ye here in the presence of God and of this congregation renew the solemn promise and vow that was made in your name at your baptism?" And Lewis says yes. This is something that Lewis greatly regretted later in his life. He was attesting, by saying yes, he was attesting to belief in the Christian faith, but he didn't have any such belief. And for him, as he reflected on this later, this was an ultimate act of hypocrisy for which he was so ashamed. And he said, "I allowed myself to be prepared for confirmation and confirmed and to make my first communion in total disbelief, acting apart, eating and drinking my own condemnation." He was very embarrassed by this in his adult life after his conversion, that he had done something so foolish. And maybe we can all take something from that, that when we say those words, whether it's in the service of confirmation or the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, those things that we say in worship, that we examine ourselves and ask the Lord to help us in our unbelief. What brought Lewis from a nominal Christian background in his early years to a hardened atheism? Well, from several sources on Lewis, and particularly in the book by Kilby that I mentioned to you earlier, there are five things, and these are things that I think Kilby really enumerates. There are five things that I think really influenced him. His attempts to stir his emotions in prayer, which I mentioned. Occultism. Won't get deeply into that, but primarily through literature and in the academic environment. Lust. Both his own struggles with that as well as what came through the literature. Pessimism and secular philosophical reading, some of the philosophers that he was reading at that time. And if you're looking for more on that, as I mentioned, this is a great resource for getting a little bit of background on that. I think we have about 5 minutes. Push forward a few years. As Lewis matured, his beliefs gradually began to change. In 1926, he came to believe in a nebulous power outside himself. He even went so far as to say that Christianity was very sensible apart from his Christianity. Well, what does that mean? What did he mean by that? Well, he began to think, as he examined things, that this is all very reasonable. It makes sense, except for all of this miraculous stuff and the idea that this myth is true. This system of morality and things of that nature. This all makes sense. If it weren't for this Jesus fellow dying and coming to life again, that sounds so much like pagan mythology. From George Sayre's biography of Lewis here on the top of the third page, there's a quote. By 1926, he was a practicing atheist who had no belief in the gospel story or in the doctrine that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. He had read The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton and had come to feel that Christianity was very sensible apart from its Christianity. So he runs across Chesterton and he reads The Everlasting Man. And this is what gets him to thinking about some of these things, the reasonableness of the faith. He's still wrestling with this whole myth, the whole mythology of the faith. But he was inspired by an offhand remark by another atheist to examine in detail the doctrines of Christianity, and so he began to do so, particularly focusing on evidence for the historicity of the Gospels. And so he's there at Oxford in this academic environment, in this environment with all of these great literary figures around him. And he begins digging into these things, really getting, taking an academic approach to digging into this. And again, collapsing the story a good bit. In 1929, he became a theist. In his autobiography, he wrote, "In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed, perhaps that night the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England." And thereafter, he began attending church services and became increasingly interested in religion. Now, this is the point where Alistair McGrath, in his biography of Lewis, which is overall a very good biography, but Dr. McGrath, I think, spends a little too much time in the details of the dates of Lewis' conversion, which is all fine, but I don't know that it really matters a lot. In the end, McGrath thinks that Lewis' conversion was about 6 months shorter than Lewis himself records in Surprised by Joy and other biographers thought. And he bases this on some of his research in the primary sources and on the fact that Lewis mentions the blooming bluebells by the side of the road as he was on his drive to the zoo. And McGrath says it was the wrong time of year for the bluebells to be blooming. Well, so what? So if you read McGrath's book, it's a good biography, but there's some details that I think are extraneous. Not that I could do a better job. In 1931, Lewis discovered that his brother Warney had been thinking of becoming a Christian and had been attending church services also, and so they began attending services together. But Lewis still had problems believing the fullness of the faith. He couldn't understand the sacraments or how certain Christian concepts and ideas were different from those found in the pagan mythologies. And as Bishop Sutton mentioned a couple of days ago, whenever it was that we started this conference, in his session. On the evening of September the 19th, 1931, Lewis had a long discussion well into the night in the early morning with J.R. Tolkien and Hugo Dyson, talking about the mythology of Christianity. And this pair assured Lewis of the validity of the Christian myth and the truth of God, the reality of God. Now, Lewis didn't have all of his questions resolved in that one conversation, all of those still lingering questions. But that was the night that pushed him over in his thinking about all these things. He actually says, referring to the drive to the zoo and the bluebells, that's when he said he set out. He's riding in the sidecar of the motorcycle with his brother on the way to the zoo. And he says when they left, he didn't believe these things. And when they arrived there at their destination, he did believe all these things about the faith. And that's where some point to his conversion. Well, remember that indelible mark of baptism. He couldn't get away. The name of Christ was placed upon him, and he was sealed in the community of the faith. Now, I wouldn't extrapolate that to all people, that we can therefore say everyone who's been through baptism will affirm that faith in their when they come to a place where they can in their reason and in practice of their life. But he is certainly brought into the covenant, and it haunted him. In his atheism, he was haunted by this myth, this Christian myth. All right, I've got to stop. I'm sorry again that I couldn't get through everything here. Let me just hit one or two other points quickly. Oddly enough, coincidentally, for whatever it's worth, on September 22nd, 1931, Lewis' conversion to Christianity was complete. That's when he had the motorcycle ride. On Christmas Day of that year, he received Holy Communion for the first time since his childhood. And incidentally, his brothers in Shanghai, Lewis is in England, and his brothers in Shanghai, and they both received communion on the same day for the first time since their childhood. And, you know, coming from my Pentecostal background, I kind of get, when people talk about those sorts of things, I get edgy anymore, since I don't affirm to, ascribe to those things anymore. But the Lord works in a mysterious way. And in the lives of these two brothers, he was obviously at work to bring them together in their family relationship into the fullness of his family. Okay, let me stop there. A couple of quick questions, as long as you're willing to sit here for a moment. Yes, sir. From what I find, no. He examined that question, should he convert? But he primarily seemed to just be happy to be in the default position in the Church of England. He did read, I think it was Tolkien who really pressured him to some degree to convert to Roman Catholicism, but it really had no effect in the end on him as far as him deciding to do so. He did examine, he did read some things that Tolkien gave him, I believe, to that end. And I know a lot of Catholics who seem to be under the impression that Lewis did convert, and in the end, does it really matter? I don't know, but doesn't seem to be any evidence for that.
Joseph Pierce, who is a Catholic doctor, writes a series of books on quite people who have converted to Catholicism. Mm-hmm. I think the way he treats Lewis is he didn't really need the aim of children to convert to Catholicism.
Well, we can say he certainly came to Catholic ideas. And whether he went to St. Peter's or not, again, in the end, does it matter in the face of God? But that he came into the fullness of Catholicism. Yes?
A1, does that imply that he was under pressure by certain parties to take which sides here?
I don't know that he was in particular This is something I wanted to point out more, and sorry that I didn't get it in, and please don't let me hold you up if you need to go ahead and step out. But there was this recurring theme in Lewis's life. So he grew up in this ultra-conservative, evangelical, low-church environment, and they hated the Roman Catholics, but then the church is built by an Anglo-Catholic. And he goes to this school and is immersed in this Anglo-Catholic parish. And then he goes, you know, throughout his life, he's in his various circumstances. He spent over 30 years of his life at Holy Trinity Church in Headington Quarry. And this is his pew. And he sat by the stone column so everyone wouldn't see him there. And this was an Anglo-Catholic parish. And he said, whatever the local church is, that's where I should go. It's not important it's churchmanship. It's important that it's the place of worship. And so I don't know that there were particular pressures on him to subscribe to one party or another, but that was his approach. And I think you see this in this influence in his early life, and I think that's a part of what influenced him into his adulthood. Yes? I was referring to my own Pentecostal background. Just the fact that he and his brother had this, both took communion on the same day on two different sides of the world for the first time since their childhood. This mysterious event or coincidental event. Lewis, one of the things I didn't get to touch on, but there were a few odd little views Lewis had on various things. Have a message for us? Yes. One of those was on speaking in tongues, and he made some remarks about that in